I'm Chip Hessenflower.
And I'm Pam Bedard.
And we're back again for our daily podcast, the 20th short story in our collection. This one is The Adventure of the Resident Patient. 20 of these so far, guys. This is so much fun. I hope everybody out there is listening along and working on these puzzles, working on these mysteries together. What's this one about?
So The Resident Patient is about a young academically talented doctor who arrives at 221B Baker Street with a mystery involving his benefactor who lives upstairs. There are Russians who have apparently intruded into his room. Sherlock has to uncover the reason these strangers' lives have intersected. And this is an interesting one because it opens with a long sort of philosophical discussion by Watson, who's looking over his memoirs and thinking about how he chooses the specific tales that he's sharing with the reader. And there's a real historiography feeling to this, like thinking about how history gets constructed. And Watson tells us that some of the cases where Sherlock's reasoning is most impressive are actually pretty commonplace, while others are super dramatic but don't really showcase Sherlock's methods. So it's hard for him to choose what to show us. And he talks about, I don't know if you guys noticed this phrase, he speaks of the Scylla and Charybdis, which are forever threatening the historian. And Scylla and Charybdis are mythical sea monsters. And that phrase really just means about like choosing evils or being caught between a rock and a hard place. And so he starts with this really sort of like thoughtful historiographic notion of how stories get told, but also how history gets constructed. So it's kind of a fun one, just on a philosophical basis.
And it's very interesting how we think of history. We're looking at these stories 130 years later and still seeing how these stories have affected storytelling since. And it's so interesting that Conan Doyle was thinking of how this history has been constructed and how it will go forward.
Well, I'm thinking also about Doyle, just thinking about how to build Sherlock Holmes' myth up even more. Well, you know, he's got all these adventures over here. We really don't get to experience those, but they're so impressive. But just know they're out there. So, you know, as wonderful as the ones we get today, there's even more out there.
Well, and I love that so many, and Watson mentions this many times, you know, they're about famous people. So we really, he's not at liberty to tell us the story. We've probably already heard the scandal sheet version of the story, but we don't know of Holmes's involvement. So again, it's both that invitation to write your own Sherlock Holmes story and part of the game of pretending that Sherlock is a real person.
And it gets a little philosophical here. After this little conversation, Watson and Holmes go for a walk around London. And the quote says, "For 3 hours, we strolled about together, watching the ever-changing kaleidoscope of life as it ebbs and flows through Fleet Street and the Strand." That is a great turn of phrase, the ever-changing kaleidoscope of life.
Well, that's what writers do, Steve. Well, you know, obviously they must have the coronavirus going on, because for many of our communities, one of the few things we can do is go for long strolls out in our neighborhoods or wherever we are. 3 hours, though, that seems amazing, though.
And we wouldn't be able to stroll together. At least we'd have to be 6 feet apart, of course.
Yes. Or as I've learned, when I see a bunch of kids coming up the sidewalk, I get on the road and have to, you know, let them pass by.
But what you two have been doing is been comparing your mileage that you've been getting on your walks. So you have that connectedness, even in this situation. You are sending each other messages saying, I got 8 miles this today. And the other one goes, yeah, I did too. And I'm sitting there going, yeah, I had a donut.
Well, Steve,
I've also had many donuts.
That's right. How else can we build this belly? It doesn't just build itself, Steve.
However, well, going back to Fleet Street and the Strand. So in the 19th century, we have this figure of the stroller. And I always love when you want to actually study something, you have to make it sound a little bit better. So they turn it into French, le flâneur. So this very important cultural theorist, Walter Benjamin, wrote about the flâneur at this exact time, who is like a sociologist at work who walks around and looks at life in all its different versions in London. And there's a real issue of class, like wealthy urban guys who are walking around and sort of looking down on the poor. Now, I think with the Sherlock and Watson duo, I don't think they're looking down at anyone. I think, you know, they are of the leisure classes. At the same time, I feel like they're so fascinated by all the different things that are happening in their city. So I don't think they are flâneurs, although sometimes people have read them that way.
Well, I'm wondering if Doyle, a lot like Dickens, strolled the streets, because where do you get ideas? How do you work out stories? Well, sometimes going and moving yourself away from your home or wherever you write, your office, allows you to, you know, kind of experience. You get a burst of creativity by seeing something. It could be anything. Somebody sold popcorn on the side and somebody bought the popcorn. It could give you the spark of creativity. So when you get back and you are writing your story, you've got something to draw from. And in many ways, Holmes and Watson strolling keeps Sherlock Holmes sharp, as if he's not already sharp.
Absolutely. I do imagine that Doyle would walk around, because one of the things that I'm always reminded of when I reread stories is how good his descriptions are. He is so good at just describing all of these characters who walk into Holmes's office. I mean, he has to describe a bunch of new people every time. He comes up with great ways of physically describing them. And I feel like he's a people watcher, right? Like, he's getting his ideas from looking at all the people in his busy, busy city. I would just note that in this opening, which is actually a very large part of the story before we meet the customer, the client, Sherlock actually reads what Watson is thinking. They're both just sitting in their sitting room. And suddenly Sherlock tells Watson exactly what he's thinking and how he followed his eyes looking at two different pictures. And, you know, Watson always is super, super impressed. But Sherlock references a story that they read and how Watson said you couldn't just guess what someone's thinking. And so Sherlock was trying to prove that you can. And he doesn't say what the story is, but I would expect it's probably Edgar Allan Poe's Dupin stories. So these were from the 1840s, typically considered the first modern detective stories. He wrote three. I think I've mentioned them before on this podcast, but just noting that he's almost certainly referencing Dupin, who has an unnamed narrator who writes down his wonderful stories of deduction.
Interesting. How interesting for him to make reference to something that he is certainly using that idea for this writing to make this even more realistic for the reader. Holmes and Watson get back to 221 Baker Street and they find Dr. Percy Trevelyan standing there. And Holmes, of course, immediately knows that this person is a doctor and he's got the evidence there. And they ask him in and we get to the mystery here, where this doctor has a benefactor who has been supporting his medical practice.
Yeah, I found that very interesting. And my thought on that was, I wonder if Doyle is trying to communicate to the masses on how the contracts work, or how if you are a person who has a skill and you were going to make a deal with a benefactor, how it would work. And I kept thinking, all right, so with the benefactor, the person who basically is supporting the practice, who asked the doctor to open a practice, basically keeps 3/4 of the revenue. And the doctor keeps 1/4 of the revenue. And then the benefactor basically took care of all the expenses of the practice. At least that's the way I read it. The building's maintenance and all that stuff would be taken care of by the benefactor. Yeah, you know, once again, I don't know if that was standard practice at the time. And I don't even know if that's the right contract. But I'm wondering, once again, if Doyle is trying to communicate to the everyday Joe, this is how this stuff works.
That's interesting. I love your perspective on this. I did not catch that 3/4 of the doctor's revenue is sent to the benefactor. That seems like a lot.
Well, I don't know if it is a lot. I'm privy to some contracts put together, some people who put together some pretty interesting things. And I don't know if that's standard practice, but, you know, if you're a person who needs to bring something to the market, you can become very wealthy keeping your quarter, as this contract was written. And this person, we learn why he was this was important to him and why he needed to keep a low profile later on in our story. But I'm just wondering, where would you get this information? Where would the average person get that information? And if you were presented with some kind of offer, how would you know it's a good offer or not? Unless it's written in a story that a lot of people read. This seems very interesting to me.
See, yeah, I really like that. Pop culture is important.
Absolutely. And of course, Doyle himself was a medical doctor. And so I would trust him to have a pretty good sense of what kind of contracts might be appropriate.
And if you think back, we learned about how much you should pay a secretary or assistant earlier in one of the stories. And I'm just, you know, once again, this is kind of just dribbling out there. And whether that's the current price today, I don't know. But let's just say he's giving us some insight.
Interesting. Dr. Percy Trevelyan says that his own hobby has always been nervous disease. He wishes that he could make it an absolute specialty, but he just took what he could get. He's a very young doctor in his 30s, and he just took this job because it was going to pay some of the bills. He says that he won a Bruce Pinkerton Prize for his study in the field. This has got to be a reference to Alan Pinkerton detective stories, right, Pam?
Oh, I would think so. I definitely chuckled when I got there.
And we've discussed the Pinkerton stories before. These are some of the detective stories that came out of America, right, at the time?
Yes. And of course, Alan Pinkerton actually was a historical character. So this is a case, it's the opposite of Holmes, in that an actual real life detective wrote up his memoirs, but fictionalized them dramatically. And then, so that's what's happening in the US. And then in London at the same, a little bit later, Pinkerton's stories would have come out in the 60s and 70s. And then with Sherlock Holmes, we have this 100% fictional character, but who people think is real. So it's they're a funny combination.
The doctor has been studying something called catalepsy, which is characterized by a trance or a seizure with a loss of sensation and consciousness accompanied by rigidity of the body. This Russian comes to him and says that he has this catalepsy, which nomenclature-wise is a combination of what? Catatonic epilepsy? Interesting. And he says that he has this and it goes into a trance of sorts. Sherlock later says, "This is a fraudulent imitation, Watson, though I should hardly dare to hint as much to our specialist. It is a very easy complaint to imitate. I've done so myself," says Holmes. Of course he has. Of course he's faked a seizure or a trance accompanied by a rigidity of the body. We've seen this a couple of times where he has faked other ailments, and of course he's done this one.
Well, we saw it in the scandal in Bohemia, right?
Well, this also reminds me a little bit about sort of a contemporary, the Amazing Randy, who is the gentleman who spent his career debunking these types of myths, if you're familiar with that guy.
Yes. There was also a moment here where after they talk to the doctor and hear all his story, Holmes says, "But we may sleep on it now, for I shall be surprised if we do not hear something further from Brook Street in the morning." He says this to Watson. And it's really funny because this is something Holmes does often, right? He says, "Well, we've got all of our information. Now we just sleep on it." And there's actually quite a lot of evidence that sleeping on it actually really, really works. I listened to this great book by Matthew Walker, who's a sleep scientist. And I was astonished by all of the different studies that have been done that show how if you're working on math or music or reading or anything, really, if you want to study for an exam, cramming is the worst thing you can do. Just do your work and then get a great night's sleep, and you actually will process a ton of what you've encountered while you sleep, and you'll have a substantially better understanding of it in the morning. Something that Holmes is doing 130 years before we have the imaging to show it's a good idea, but it is.
Well, almost every culture has some version of, if you're making important decisions, to sleep on it.
Exactly.
And it works the same way.
Yes, I think that it's important that we use our time, and our mental ability while we're sleeping is still there. There's all sorts of things that go through my head while I'm sleeping, and I wake up and I go, what was my brain trying to tell me in this one? I don't understand this episode. I'm going to go on to the next one. I do that often. Doyle seems to always mention the type of carriage that the characters are using. Have you noticed that? We see all sorts of different names of the different characters. This time, it's a vehicle called a brougham, which if you look it up, it looks a lot like what you might imagine the Munster's car was based on. A compartment on the inside for the passengers and then the driver on the outside. This was the vehicle that was then designed into some of the first automobiles in England.
Of course, your love of automobiles comes out here.
Well, my love of the monsters comes out here, really. But anyway, the first automobiles in England hit the streets at about this time in history. The first one was recorded in 1892 and a second one in 1895, right around the time of this writing. Again, we see the theme of technology in these stories.
Well, he's a modern guy, Steve.
And I've actually seen papers on Holmes about the different kinds of carriages, as well as about the different kinds of communication technologies, telephones and telegrams. I'm thinking about the copper beaches, the importance of the telegraph. So certainly this interest in late 19th century technology is all over these stories.
And you know, it's even kids today with their steampunk and stuff like that kind of are still some kind of homage to this era.
Yeah.
Those changes in technology that certainly spark a change in culture. One of these days, Pam, we are going to read The Devil in the White City, where the World's Fair here in Chicago changed everything about culture because of the massive amounts of technology that were presented in that World's Fair.
Oh, I've been meaning to read that and I still haven't. Tell me when you're going to do it. I would love to read with you.
Wonderful. This is our second story that involves hanging. We have the benefactor upstairs decides, apparently, to hang himself. And the police give a very interesting quote on this, and I want to know about this. The policeman says, "It's about 5 a.m. You know that suicides are most common." That would be about the time for the hanging for this case. It seems to have been a very deliberate affair. Have you ever heard this idea that suicides are most common at 5 a.m?
Steve, I've never heard this.
No, that but it really stood out to me.
As so odd. Yeah.
So definitive as that statement.
And in this case, it's not a suicide at all, as Holmes quickly realizes from looking at the forensic evidence of the three cigars, different from the dead man's, and there's a third set of footprints. And I love how Holmes is like, oh no, I could tell which footprints are on top of which other, which I'm not sure is actually forensically possible, but who knows?
Well, you know, let's go back to the cigars and the fireplace. It just seems so obvious that you would look at the, and to make sure that they're the same. And then immediately he says, well, you know, check inside this guy's coat pocket or whatever to see what type of cigars he's smoking. One guy's bites off his cigars. The other one cuts off the ends of his cigars. Okay. Holy cow. It just seems so obvious today, but at that time it must have been groundbreaking.
Well, absolutely, because this is really the earliest, speaking of technology, right? This is really the beginning of forensic investigation, which we take so for granted, given all of the access we have to television programs that focus on forensics.
We've talked about this before. These methods were actually used by actual investigators after these writings, the idea of checking the evidence, finding the tiny little clues like cigars in the fireplace would be a part of the investigation from then on.
Right. And also just assuming that a suicide should always be investigated to see if it's really a homicide. That's a new idea.
That makes sense. Also, the idea here of witness protection is brought up. It turns out that this benefactor, Blessington, was a member of a bank robbery gang who, and this guy is the guy who turned informant in order to stay out of jail. The quote says, "However wretch as he was still living under the shield of British law. And I have no doubt, Inspector, that you will see that though the shield may fail to guard, the sword of justice is still there to avenge." This is Holmes being very dark on this, isn't it?
Well, that's a dark night. That's the dark night right there, Steve.
He seems to be judging that this guy got out of going to jail by turning informant, and his compatriots came and took their vengeance upon him.
Well, Steve, it just reads so Batman, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. That is a very Batman statement, that's for sure.
Well, and you know me and my interest in endings. Once again, we have a case where we have some sort of justice that's bigger than the police system, right? So we get this criminal vigilante kind of justice. And then at the very end, from that night, nothing had been seen of the three murderers by the police. And it is surmised at Scotland Yard that they were among the passengers of the ill-fated steamer. Once again, right, we have our criminal dying at sea, which was lost with all hands upon the Portuguese coast, some leagues to the north of Oporto. So this is just like Five Pips, where Sherlock figured out who the criminals were, but then they were lost at sea before they could be dealt with by the criminal justice system.
Don't worry. The gods have taken care of this for everyone. Mm-hmm. Right at the world, right there.
The sea monsters, right? We opened with those two sea monsters. And so that's who ends up taking care of this.
But I'm a little more satisfied by this ending because these guys had already gone to jail. They had already been released. They had already been punished for their crime. Not for this crime, not for the murder of this guy. But yeah, there's a little bit of fate stepped in here and took care of these guys. Interestingly, the ship that they are said to be on was the Nora Karenina, which is also the name of the ship mentioned in The Wrecker from 1892 by Robert Louis Stevenson. So
I didn't know that. That's super interesting. So wait, was that a real ship then?
There are several ships in history with that name, but there is no wreck of that ship at that time. In this Robert Louis Stevenson story, there is. So is this a crossover? Did Doyle think of this because he read that story a year before? I don't know.
Or maybe this is one of the puzzles that the reader should pick up, because you know, Stevenson's work certainly was well-known work at the time. And this is certainly Sherlock Holmes is aimed at the greater masses. So you know, just like you picked that up, because you know, Steve, you know so much. I'm assuming that many of the readers picked it up during that time.
I'm a little creeped out by this. So this is a real ship that didn't sink, and in the Sherlock Holmes story, it does. Ooh.
After it does in the Robert Louis Stevenson story from the year previous.
Interesting.
Maybe they're friends as writers, and it's a way to kind of, you know, tap something in there. Artists sometimes will put something in their paintings that's an homage to a friend of theirs who may be a contemporary artist. I'm assuming writers do the same thing.
Yeah, sure. I don't know about this one, but yeah.
I think it's a crossover episode. I think that it's one of those episodes where all the Chicago TV shows, Chicago Fire, Chicago, everything else, they all film in the same place. And so they just occasionally show up on each other's sets because they're all in the same place. That's what this is. This is just a very special episode.
Or if they go from The Love Boat to Fantasy Island, Steve, you know, they do that quite a bit.
That's a more contemporary reference. Good job, Chip. So
for all our Gen Xers out there.
Right. All of our Gen Xers that are really good at staying at home because we're used to it. Good job, Gen X. Go us. So what's next, Pam?
Oh, I think you're going to like the next one. We are going to meet someone that you perhaps have heard of before from the canon in the next story, which is the Greek interpreter. So we're going to get a little more up close and personal with Sherlock and his family.
Wow.
Oh, I know. I know who it is. I'm excited. That is one of my favorite characters. I am ready. There's some great actors who have played that character over the years. I look forward to this conversation tomorrow, the Greek interpreter. I hope all of you out there are listening along and enjoying our banter, even when we go off on tangents today. Boy, did we go off on tangents. But I hope that you're enjoying our conversation about Sherlock Holmes. We want to hear from you. Give us a call. Give us a text. Send us a voicemail. We would love to hear from you. Make sure you're following our hashtag TMS Sherlock Holmes for all of this conversation. And join us tomorrow for the adventure of the Greek interpreter with an exciting guest star. I look forward to that very much. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflug.
And I'm Pam Fedor.
We'll see you in the future. What I want to talk about, what I want to think about.